Onassis Foundation. DubLab. Welcome to The Quarantine Tapes, a daily podcast from Onassis LA and DubLab. Hosted by Paul Holdengraber, this series chronicles shifting paradigms in the era of social distancing.
Hello, could I please speak with Jason Moran?
This is he.
Hello, Jason. What a pleasure to have you on this call. This is Paul Holdengraber calling you from The Quarantine Tapes, which is co-presented by Onassis LA and DubLab, and actually also in association with OxyArts. I have the great pleasure of speaking with you and also EJ Hill and Maurice Harris. So I'm really delighted. Thank you for taking the time.
Really, my pleasure. My pleasure.
It's really a pleasure to speak to you. And, you know, in preparing to talk to you and immersing myself in your work, I thought of Melvin Gibbs, who I had the pleasure of speaking to also on The Quarantine Tapes. And I remember him talking about how at the moment of George Floyd's assassination, he immediately went to work on a piece. And I was reading the same about you. And when the Capitol was attacked and ambushed, you went immediately to work on The Sound Will Tell You. And I thought there was a real parallel in some way. And then as I begin to read about The Sound Will Tell You and listen to it, Toni Morrison comes in. And Toni Morrison says this, and I'd like you to, in a way, unpack this quotation and give me some context. Toni Morrison says, "This is precisely the time when artists go to work. There is no time for despair, no place for self-pity, no need for silence, no room for fear. We speak, we write, we do language. That is how civilizations heal."
Wow. Yeah, I mean, well, Toni speaks for a lot of us, thankfully, and is able to find the language to kind of inspire people. And I always think that depending on what form you're working in, that it is always precisely the moment to be in action. I have not been taught by any artist or musician that was never not in action mode. They lived a life navigating circumstances beyond their control. Therefore, they knew their relationship with their instrument. The music that they would make would always amplify the struggle, but it would also amplify the joy. And, you know, my teachers did not shy away from these kinds of tough conversations, and they laid it into their music. And so I've only been taught by musicians who did that. And there never is an off switch. Some artists aren't granted that privilege of having an off switch.
You don't go home and close the shop.
I wish it was that easy. And I think for most of us, that's precisely the reason we are artists, is that we can't, you know, just turn it off and lock it away until the moment we're ready to pull it out. Because our art form is also about a livelihood. It's about a community. It's about an ecology. And if we don't allow that into our work, then, you know, I don't want to be that kind of artist.
No. In a sense, you know, Arthur Miller, when he said attention must be paid, that's what it's about.
Mm-hmm. And there's a detail that I think evolves or out of that attention to the detail. And I think sometimes, I think early, like I might think in my career or early in my mode of studying, there was you might want to feel like you could have an objective viewpoint on a song. When in reality, all the people that I was attracted to as music makers did not have an objective viewpoint. They had their viewpoint. And it's a tough thing to kind of realize that you play a song, not necessarily for the audience, but as a reflection of who you are. And then you have to find the repertoire that amplifies that.
You know, I mentioned Melvin Gibbs at the start of our conversation. And in the conversation I had with him, I referenced a piece of his where he tries to, in some way, describe what jazz is. And, you know, everybody always speaks about improvisation, of course. But his take on it was extraordinary to me. His take was, it's an African-American experience. Improvisation is what we need every day.
Right, right. Yeah, and Melvin is a close friend. We just were playing together last week.
Oh, really?
Berkeley. Yeah. And I've been thankful for Melvin, actually, during these past few years, also because Melvin is also a really great writer. So I said, oh, I look forward to your book deal. And he said, well. So I also understand this way of trying to frame it. The hard thing about talking about music, and especially Black improvised music, is that it continues to evolve. And the places where we think the improvisation occurs, sometimes it's occurring around the corner from there. And that is also the beauty of it, that it's, you know, a thing that revolves not only around the feeling of getting from point A to point B, but it also allows for geography to come into the context. It allows for slang to happen, you know, slang from, you know, East L.A. versus Compton, two different kinds of slang, you know. And if you go from, you know, Houston to New Orleans, the slang is different. So therefore, what does it sound like in music? What does the slang sound like? And that's how we get a regional and maybe a kind of a sense of understanding of what America sounds like in improvised form, that it lives in the history of this music that has gone and recorded for the past 120 years.
You know, I love what you say about the artists you really love. They are the ones who cannot be in some way categorized or contained. It made me think of a wonderful line of Napoleon. He said of one of his generals, he knew everything but nothing else. And in a sense, that's exactly what you're fighting. Or in a sense, you're trying to recreate in your own world, let's say the Harlem Renaissance.
It's a struggle, I think.
I can imagine.
And none of us really kind of reach the point where we feel like we have made it. I think maybe even thinking of someone like Duke Ellington, who will celebrate his 125th birthday in 2024. But Duke Ellington, born in 1899, you know, somehow gracefully found a way to the piano and out to the world. From D.C. to New York, you know, he found a way of amplifying the complexity of the people he lived around, of the experiences his family had, the relationships within his bands and the people around him. He found a way to make that universal. It is really tough to do that elegantly. And right now, because of how, available, I'll say, media is to everyone to not only absorb it, but to also make it. That the script is changing, and artists are having to figure out well what script is the worthwhile script to continue to sink our teeth into, not only to read but to create. If we've been making records for 120 years, is that still the model? You know, like I wrestle with it, and I guess the wrestling then becomes the work, as Adrian Piper has taught me. You know.
But also when I reference the Harlem Renaissance, as I understand it from immersing myself in your work, it's also about the extraordinary conversation that people had, the fact that they were in touch with each other, the fact that they were not disciplined in the sense that they were not disciplinary. And it reminded me of the philosopher Bernard Williams, who said, we should remember that work may be unimaginative, not because it is badly argued, but because it is arguing with the wrong people.
Yeah, I'll second that. That's great. Yeah, there was something also intriguing, whether it was true or not, but as a student, that when I moved to New York in the 90s and felt this incredible attraction, not only to the jazz history that lives on these streets and in these basements and in these halls, but it was also, you know, to what I thought I would understand as the Harlem Renaissance, where artists were talking to each other. So it wasn't just the musicians with the musicians, or the painters with the painters, or the choreographers with the choreographers. And that the the way it seemed was that the community was in dialogue with one another, and each other needed one another to figure out how to etch forward on the conversation, the struggle,
how to live,
and also and how to live, yeah, and also to and to still make a living as an artist. I mean, you still got to understand, like, it's still for me, it's still crazy that people want to sign up to do that, be a sculptor, because in America the frame around it is that it's, you know, it's it, one, it's useless. There's no function for it. And two, we don't support it as a government, as a thing. And so how did these artists, they were, I mean, you know, these are artists living in the 1920s who really were striking out into a, for me, understanding what real abstraction was. That there was no Duke Ellington that they were like, oh, okay, we can see Duke Ellington grow old in his life, and I can pattern my life after him. There was nobody like that. There was no Billie Holiday to say, okay, you know, this is how you can use your voice. Like, it was just being born. And that is a real kind of bravery, a kind of support structure, but also a bravery to be able to stand on a podium in front of a microphone and speak a truth, whether it's yours or your friends, but be able to speak it to an audience that would find it universal enough for it to carry on around the world. It's something that I still marvel at, the bravery of these artists during that time.
You know, in immersing myself in your work again, I came across this anecdote, which seems to me much more than an anecdote. And I had the great pleasure, Jason, yesterday of watching that moment, that extraordinary moment when Miles Davis is on the Arsenio Hall show. And it is, it's truly one of the most extraordinary moments I've watched on tape. I mean, Miles Davis is always extraordinary to listen to, but also to hear talk. And I love how it starts when he's asked if he dislikes the word legend, and he says, "Yes, I'm not finished."
Right.
I'm not finished. But that show, if you could, for our listeners, tell how much of an impact it had on you. Because I think in a way, it everything that I come across when I think about your work is how important listening is, and listening in all circumstances.
Right. Yeah, Miles Davis as a guest on Arsenio Hall's show, sitting on the couch and they're having a conversation, and somehow, you know, Miles begins talking about going to, you know, how he gets his inspiration is that he's always listening. And he talks about going to the Lakers game, and this is like the Magic Johnson Lakers, like Kareem Abdul-Jabbar Lakers, like these are this is like quite a group. And so he's talking about being at the game, and he said, "Nah, I get inspiration from hearing how the ball bounces and how the tennis, the sneakers squeak on the floor, on the hardwood floor." And I thought, what is he talking about? I mean, I was a young teenager hearing this great trumpeter talk about listening to the sneakers on the floor at a Lakers game as inspiration. And I didn't know what Fluxus was. I wasn't thinking about anything like that, right? It was just, this is Miles Davis, who, when you listen to the way he asserts himself on the trumpet, it is not like how Louis Armstrong, who is pointing his trumpet up into the air as his clarion call. Miles Davis is pulling on the inside, you know, he puts a mute over his horn. He sometimes squeaks words out of the horn that he's not sure he's ready to share yet. There's something about intimate that about that listening experience that he shared. And on this, you know, Arsenio Hall show, I just thought, I don't know, I think, you know, I usually hear artists talk about when they were watching television and they watch some PBS show and they hear this thing that's like, that was it for me.
Right.
It was hearing Miles talk about sound is everywhere, and as a musician, you are going to have to wake and train your ear to hear that way.
And again, attention must be paid.
Yeah.
And it must be paid to the smallest possible detail, which may in fact, once you pay attention to it, be anything but a detail. I was also so interested, Jason, in reading about this time you've spent in these crazy 2 years we've had teaching during the pandemic, and how teaching during the pandemic was a palliative in some way for touring, of course, and for also performing with students. But you use this time to teach the students to listen. Deep listening. Yeah. Deep listening. I can't tell you how envious I am of your students having that moment. Describe a little bit what happens when you do that with them.
I mean, it's been very tough because I think a young musician, I teach at New England Conservatory in Boston, but during the pandemic, teaching online was something that I always dreaded doing because, well, you know, there's something about hearing sound waves in a room that, you know, that when you're working with someone, it's best to talk about the sound waves in the room. But I've tried to figure out a way to be a supportive instructor. And the best way was to go back into the catalog.
Right.
And there's been something that has changed in the listening habit for the ordinary listener and consumer. That the listener can listen to things in snatches and feel like they know it, right? And that wasn't necessarily the case for a lot of musicians up to one generation ago. It was really had to sit down with the record and listen to it and find yourself in it and then use it as the textbook that it was. So I wanted my students to go back into catalogs. I wanted them to bring me not only the song and the catalog that was important to them, but I wanted to show them the important parts of the catalog they might be missing in their listening. Something happened not only when in America, but in the teaching of jazz, where the segregation, not only of a people, but also of a time period, students would only listen to things that were kind of like around the breaking point of the 60s, maybe the 50s, a little bit of the 40s forward, and not the other way around. And I needed the student to go backwards. So we listened to the blues, which is the backbone of American sound. And I said, we got to listen to it because unfortunately the school doesn't have a blues class, but let's say we're going to make a blues class right now and listen to Robert Johnson again and listen to Sister Rosetta Tharpe again and really watch how she strikes chords, how she stares into her audience. And let's think of who the quote unquote they is in her song. And it opened up lots of conversations that I'm not sure I would have had if we were in person. But somehow being able to dive into it online gave us a little bit more freedom, strangely enough.
What kind of conversation? What kind of conversation surprised you that was new, that wouldn't have happened otherwise, that this opportunity in a way gave you?
Yeah, well, let's say, I mean, we were talking about Billie Holiday for a while. And one of the students, a woman saxophonist, it was maybe midway through the semester, and she decided to do a version of one of Billie Holiday's pieces. And somehow, when she shared the work with us, the conversation switched into talking about sexual abuse. And because I think it was important to, when we were considering Billie Holiday, it's not simply the song, it's like she's really digesting a lot in her songs. And we know that she was around a community of people who were abusive to her. And this student shared a very private story. Maybe she shared it with other people too, but she shared it with the class of about 10 people of something. In all my years of teaching, no one has kind of dove that deep, and it shocked everyone. But I think she found a bravery in Billie Holiday's voice. And that's what it was that I asked her, when was the first time you heard Billie Holiday? She said, when I was around 12 or 13, as she was recovering from this abuse. And she said she heard, I mean, I'm going to well up crying now.
Goodness me, goodness, me too.
She heard it in Billie's song as a young kid. And that saved her to let her know that she could survive. I don't know. I just was overwhelmed by it. And she's a great musician as well, but I'm not sure if that conversation would have happened given, you know, if we were all in a room together. Maybe it would have, but I don't know. I just thought that she was being as brave as any other person I knew by sharing that. In that moment.
But you knew, you see, what's so interesting to me is that you were talking about the bravery of the artists, and now here you have the bravery, of course she's an artist too, but the bravery of the listener. And somehow, we you know, we talk about slow reading and the importance maybe of philology, but this is in a way slow listening and the importance of commas and the importance of punctuation and the importance of taking time and the importance of listening to a whole album.
Yeah. It's essential. And I think for the future musician, I don't want any student of mine to be taking any shortcut. I need them really to know how to sow something into the ground, to water it, to give it the sun, to clear something away, you know, to let it have the room to grow. I need them to know how to do that. I was, like I said before, I really was taught by people who really cared for the music that way. And I think in these times and in the future, that we'll want really conscientious musicians to take care of sound, and not look for the simple kind of like dopamine of getting a like, but something a little bit deeper, because we have to share music. We can share it online, and I love it, believe me. But I also know that the power of civilization requires in person, and, you know, one-to-one.
And what I was so interested also in finding out as I discovered your work is the importance for you of where music is played and what places have disappeared, and in a way what role you and others have in archiving it and in saving it in some way, and the rooms in which music is played are left with all these traces. And I don't know if you know the origin of the word room is so interesting. I want to tell it to you and have you react with everything that matters to you about rooms. A room comes from Old English, room, which is a space in extent or time, a scope, an opportunity. Also from Latin, rus, an open country. The original sense held in the 14th century, make room, means clear space for oneself.
Oof. Wow. I love that. Yeah, make room. Wow. I mean, I also love that it's also about time.
Yes.
Know? And I think a lot of us, you know, who are trying to figure out what we are trying to do, and doing it despite our, you know, doubts, where we end up, we still have to question it, you know? So if you're a painter and you put it in a gallery, or you put it on the street corner or wherever, or you do a graffiti on the building, or a musician who makes sound, right? Like you play it in your living room, or you play it in your at your home, or you take it to a club, play it in a club, or you play it on the street, you know, or you take it to the church every Sunday. We have to think about where the music goes. And also when we arrive at rooms, to bring our sound into, then what does the room ask in return of us? I don't want to think that it's ever a one-way street. And for a lot of us musicians who travel the world and play thousands of different rooms, there's the phrase that for us is, well, you have to play the room. And for a while, I didn't want to understand that. I wanted to be like, no, I'm here, and I'm playing what I'm going to play.
And leave me alone, room.
leave me alone, room. But no, you have to be in conversation with the room. And the room is also the audience, too. But the room is, playing the room is a skill set. There's no class for it. You have to just go to many rooms all the time. You have to assess the sound in the bathroom. You have to assess the sound in the airport. Assess the sound on the airplane, you know. And I think for years I just didn't understand that. But Pauline Oliveros, you know, when you talk about deep listening, she really kind of helped, like, you know, be aware not only of the sound in the room, but the sound in your body, which is its own room, you know, and then the sound outside the room. And when you can hear all of those things, then you'll be ready to make a sound. And I thank Pauline for sitting my band and I down with some other people at the Park Avenue Armory and taking us through this deep listening retreat so that when I walked in a room, I was able to at least think about how to address it by responding to what the room needed, you know. And it's been, you know, it's a journey.
I remember speaking both with Henry Rollins and Sonny Rollins about this wonderful line of Sun Ra where he says, the music is listening.
Yeah. I mean, it is. I mean, and it's rarely talked about for musicians. I mean, I think after a certain level, then you figure that out. After you figured out how to, you know, make a sound and blurt something out into the air. But after a certain point, you have to assess it. And that only happens with listening. And in improvised music, you have to do it because no one has prescribed what their ending of their sentence will be. And you have possibly 8 people playing at the same time. You have to listen to everybody and also be talking at the same time, too. It's a skill that, you know, I think a lot of us are able to do, but in music, it really is a minor miracle that it can happen, that Louis Armstrong does this in the 1920s and musicians continue to this day to find a way to be simultaneously making a sound while listening to a sound. It seems easy. You know, we listen to our voice every day, we pick up the phone, you know, but there's something about the simultaneity that is also necessary for us to move forward too, that not everything stops just because you started talking, you know.
It's about giving a gift and receiving a gift.
Yes. And when that passage is happening, you know, really quickly and effortlessly between musicians listening, you know, and playing together, it is a thing that, you know, we wish we could bottle up and, you know, and share with people, because it is nothing like that feeling. It's also why musicians sacrifice their home lives.
Yeah, I was about to say to you, how about another form of listening that I've been reading about? I love this sentence about you and your wife Elise Hall Moran. You say, we have a way of being in each other's ear.
Mm. Yes, we do. Alicia is a profound musician and love of my life since 1996. And I'd also say that during the pandemic, there was something that happened, because we've always been making works together, sometimes without acknowledging that one of us had any role in it. Many times people, but now really making sure that no, these are combined efforts from both of us at the same time. And we rely on it. Alicia is a classical musician, singer, and a classical composer. And I'm a jazz musician improvising, you know. So our forms come from other spaces, but they meet in a place where we find almost the root of all Black sound, in the way that the necessary way that we must write things down, but also the way that songs are passed through an oral tradition too. And so, you know, we've been making work together, most recently the Two Wings, the music of Black America and Migration.
Migration, yes.
Yeah, that's what Melvin is a part of with his band, Harriet Tubman. So it's a constant, and Alicia does not, she's a Leo, I'm an Aquarius, and she does not take any shortcut. I'm thankful for her pressure.
That's a marvelous thing to say.
Yeah.
Thankful for her pressure.
Yeah.
That caught me off guard, but I love it.
Well, any person in a relationship, I mean, okay, the easy thing people say is the opposites attract. And that's helpful for me. But also as artists, two artists living together, there's also, we are not able to turn off that part of kind of how we assess our lives either. And we're also assessing how an artist overindulges. and sometimes we can't see it in ourselves, but we need the other person to see it for us. And we also have to give each other the freedom to make the kind of artistic successes and failures, you know. And it's how we both learn together. But so right, it's been tremendous. And now as parents, now we try to give that sensibility to our children so that they can walk through the world knowing they can improvise or write it down and feel the freedom to do both.
I love what you have to say also of being off balance, the notion that why assume that balance is such a good thing? Adam Phillips, an English psychoanalyst, wrote a whole book called On Balance where he totally agrees with you. I mean, maybe balance is just overrated.
I think it would be a joy, but I also know that as an artist, that's not what I'm signing up for.
Right.
I don't sign up to find balance. I sign up to over invest in sound and in researching it and in performing it and losing myself in it. And, you know, I think I don't know, but maybe at 10 years from now, maybe I'll find balance.
We'll speak again.
Yes, let's speak again.
You'll tell me, it's all about balance.
right. I don't know. I was young.
Yeah, exactly. Something else which, in a way, Two Wings, I think, is probably a little bit about, which is the notion of passing on. And this is a very important issue, is, how does tradition and transmission work? And Jonas Salk once asked this profound question. He asked, are we good ancestors?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, that's a tough one. I mean, and I'd say with those teachers that I mentioned earlier, that they didn't kind of discount their ability to, they were always in action. That they also taught me the reverence one should have for the previous music makers, and that sense of history should always be in my hands as a pianist. My teacher Jackie Byard, the man I moved to New York to study with at Manhattan School of Music, he was the pianist with Charles Mingus's band when that band really makes all the waves, But he talks about growing up in Massachusetts and being a young child and wanting to emulate the pianist Teddy Wilson. Teddy Wilson kind of helped break the color barrier,
course,
but he's also innovative.
Love Teddy Wilson.
It's fantastic. When I'm a student talking to this 70-year-old man about music, he will tell you about his life, but he really wants to tell you, you really should understand Earl Hines. And he'll say it enough that it'll get in my mind. I won't do any of that research while I'm studying with him, but 4 years later, then I find myself, oh my God, this is what Jackie Byard is talking about. He's talking about this relationship to the piano that spans history because the literature is there, right? We wouldn't confine ourselves as readers to only 21st century writers, right? We would have to kind of figure out, what was Zora Neale Hurston saying, versus what Toni Morrison says, versus what June Jordan says. What do these women have to say about their lives or the lives around them? So for music, it's the same thing. This way of making sure you understand and tend to the roots, too. Because the roots need, it's not just the leaves or the branches that need the sun and the rain, it's the roots need tending, too. And that, a lot of our work is also about making sure, like you said, that we are not only good custodians of ancestry, but also for our future ancestors, that there's something for them to come back on and see that would pivot them towards another path, deeper into the past. And hopefully that light, will continue to shine backwards.
When I spoke with Sonny Rollins, I asked him this question of complicated question, really, of influence. I'm always worried asking that question. But I said, when you were 7 years old, you heard Coleman Hawkins, and does it make any sense, Sonny, to talk about being influenced by Coleman Hawkins? And he paused for 2 seconds, and then he said, "I hope so."
Yeah, I've heard Sonny talk about Coleman, and it's so beautiful what Sonny Rollins says about Coleman Hawkins, because Coleman Hawkins is the essential modernist of the saxophone. He And there's something about when you experience someone shift the language that dramatically that you'll never tire of kind of discussing. So for Sonny Rollins, the fortune of us even having him to still be around. But when he was still playing, he was going to give you everything he had. And that kind of abundance of sound is very rare to experience, for me at least. And I didn't get to see John Coltrane play. But, you know, but seeing Sonny, like, give it chorus after chorus after chorus after chorus and continue to search for something else to play, that was, you know, talk about conceptual work. It was, but I think those are odes to seeing Coleman Hawkins, you know, like this kind of effortless, you know, effortless journey.
And you also work together with painters and sculptors and artists. Mm. And I'm wondering what that brings to you. I know that E.J. Hill, for instance, who I'll be speaking to very soon, is someone you're working with.
Mm. You know, like I remember when my kids were toddlers, E.J. was in residence at the Studio Museum in Harlem, and he has this beautiful piece where it's a durational piece where he lays on kind of a miniature roller coaster track. In neon, kind of like a purplish pink neon. So he's lying on this track for 8 hours a day. And my kids and I are watching him perform this at the Studio Museum. And I couldn't necessarily explain the piece to them, but what EJ allowed was a kind of interrogation of how they would hopefully understand their lives. you know, and their infatuation with roller coasters at the very same time. That there was always something that could lay you on your back, that make you still, there would be a glow around it, you know. And I think as a musician, I'm always looking for the other ways that people have figured out solutions or questions around
their work. And coming back to what you said about your mentors, your teachers, something perhaps painful, and also filled with joy.
Mm-hmm. Yes, because you can't have one without the other. There's some, I really appreciate this time we're in where people are, they feel empowered to share the moments when things aren't as rosy as they may seem on the outside. Mm-hmm. To watch Naomi Osaka really share this kind of anxiety. Other students of mine or other musicians I know to really speak kind of openly about a thing that they may have felt they would kind of shield from the public. It's really necessary to not only make an empathic musician, but also a listener too. And I mean, you know, I'd say during the pandemic is when I've had the most frequent, consistent therapy that was so helpful so thankful for the once a week Thursday call. To get me from week to week, and that these are things that, you know, should not feel like they are luxury, but a part of our diet to make sure that we can move forward with some kind of fluency.
To go in the attic or the basement to look at the old furniture.
Yes, yes, and I think, you know, as a music maker, you know, some of these songs summon up feelings that we're not quite sure we're ready to wrestle with yet. There was a song I wrote for my grandparents where they list their ancestors in names, and it's a song called Gentle Shift South. And I recorded them just saying the names, and I was playing along on the piano. And after my mother passed, I stopped playing the song. I couldn't find myself sitting on a stage or at home in private playing the piece that I knew my mother was so kind of, you know, essential to. She was the one who went with me to interview each of my grandparents, right? It was my mom. And I just couldn't do it. But during therapy, I played that song again. And then I shared it with my children. I was like, you know, like, I actually recorded my grandparents, you know. You can hear their voice on a record. Anybody can. But you should know that that document lives. And my last grandfather died a few months ago. And I reminded my cousin, I was like, look, we can always hear Papa Drew's voice, you know. He's going to sound country. He's from Louisiana, but he's saying his ancestors' names here. And again, I think through therapy kind of was helping me kind of like at least come to some sort of footing around how to even address the song again.
You know, it's so interesting to hear you talk about this because, again, you know, we spoke earlier about rooms and rooms in which great music happened. And here, in a sense, we're talking about traces and maintaining these traces. In closing, very sadly, might I say, there's one song, one composition you did during the pandemic. And perhaps in closing, you can tell us a little bit about it. It has extraordinary lyrics. I listened to it last night, and it's called Follow the Light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I don't know. I think being trapped in my apartment in New York, and I think New Yorkers really, we just didn't know what was going on, and tried to find some poetry at, you know, the hour where we all banged our pans out the windows for people who were trying to fight to live. And something was also happening because the mood, not only in the city and everywhere, was becoming darker and darker. So I was always sitting at my piano trying to write things. I ended up writing things that felt slower and darker than I might have traditionally have. But Follow the Light was the one song that really like spoke to a kind of brightness that I needed to hear. And when I started playing it in the house, about Alicia ran into the room. She's like, "What is that?" She's like, "That is great. Thank you." And that's when I also know that something is good, is if she runs in the room, like, "What is that?" And it became a song that I would then share with other people. You know, before the record was, I was just sharing with people, like, "Look, you know, here's a sound that I've made. So, you know, I hope this helps you today." And it continues to be a song that people respond to. There's something about the frequency of the key. It's kind of in the key of E or B. And there's a specific brightness to those frequencies that I think, you know, let us open our eyes a little bit wider.
And the lyrics are so beautiful. I hope you don't mind if I read them.
Sure.
Follow the light. There's a scent in the sound, crisp and greasy. And for now it carries a day. Some ask to stop and listen. Others ask to stop listening. I know light when it attacks in E. I believe when I follow. Jason, what a pleasure it's been speaking with you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
Thank you so much. And I hope when the moment comes, we meet in person.
We shall. We shall. Thank you.
All the best to you. Take good care.
Cheers.
Bye-bye.
You too.
To support this show and DubLab's progressive programming, go to dublab.com/support.